Hello, and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. And before we get into the show today, we just want to remind you that the KSKA Spring Drive kicks off on April 7th, but you can help us get a head start on reaching our $300,000 goal by making a pledge of support today at alaskapublic.org or by calling 550-8484 and help us keep bringing local programming that you love to hear each day to you. Let's continue with the rest of the show, where we are featuring something a little different. We'll hear from a World Matters storytelling event titled Foreign Faux Pas, Stories of Navigating Cultural Differences. Formatted in the style of Arctic entries, we'll hear some oh no moments from fellow Alaskans who have traveled abroad and here in the United States. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and took place at 49th State Brewing Company on March 22nd. We go now to Amanda Dale, who is a past storyteller and co-host of our own series, New Arrivals, and she moderated this event.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Welcome. Thank you for coming tonight. We're so happy to see all of you. Thanks, Alyssa, for the warm introduction. My experience with this last year was so positive, mostly because the audience was really warm and accommodating. So we have assured all the storytellers this year that World Affairs Council audiences are always nice, they're always open-minded, and they laugh at every joke. Good. Thank you. So don't disappoint them. Our first storyteller tonight, she's the director of public programming at the Alaska Humanities Forum. But before that, she's had all kinds of jobs. She was a middle school teacher. She coordinated study abroad programs. She helped write employee evaluation systems for Google. And she even worked abroad, which we'll hear a little bit more about. So please give a warm welcome to Megan Zlatos.
So you may have heard the following statistic, that men will often apply for a job when they meet just 60% of the minimum qualifications, whereas women, in general, will only apply if they meet 100% of the qualifications. Well, when I was 20 years old, I found myself in the job of translator for the referees at the semifinal European Handball Championship. And I learned that you can get a job when you're way less than 60% qualified. So how did I get it? Well, when I was a junior in college, I studied abroad in Spain in a small city about the size of Anchorage called Logroño. How many of you have been there? Yeah. No, it's not the highest on the tourist list. But the university there didn't have dorms, and I needed to get a room on a low budget. I found a room that fit my budget and a twin-size bed and not much else. I could barely open the door. And the room came with two apartment mates, one of which was a tall, blonde woman named Ilza, who had these beautiful green eyes and a boyfriend at home. And she was extremely loyal. She called him every night, but her relationship status gave her the confidence to walk up to any attractive man that she saw on the street or in a bar and tell him just how guapísimo she thought that he was. And by the way, had he met her roommate Megan, me, she would have been an absolutely killer wingwoman if it weren't for the fact that the Venn diagram of our taste in men looks something like this. There was no overlap. But oh well, we became quick, close friends, and we got to meet a lot of new people. One of the things that you should know about Ilza is that it was pretty spectacular that she was learning Spanish. It's not like they have high school Spanish in Latvia. They barely even had a Spanish-English dictionary, or sorry, Spanish-Latvian dictionary. And when she graduated from high school, they had so few professors to teach Spanish that she knew she would have to wait 3 years before she could enroll in a college Spanish program. She self-studied on her own, and by her first year of college, she was already professionally translating for the subtitles of Latin American telenovelas. And then in her second year, she came to Spain. So she was the obvious choice when the Latvian handball team proceeded to the semifinal European Handball Championship in our new home of Logroño. And when she was on the phone with the head of the handball club, the Logroño Handball Club, they were negotiating her translation fees and everything, and he said, oh, by the way, ¿hablas inglés también? Do you speak English too? And she admitted she wasn't really comfortable with English, but she had this roommate, and that was where I came in. Now, I certainly wasn't the most qualified person in town, but I thought, really, how hard could it be? I had been studying Spanish at that point for 12 years. Granted, six of those years were all first-year Spanish. And not because I kept failing, but because I kept switching schools. And it seemed like every single school I went to, whatever year that was the year the kids started Spanish. But I plugged along, and I never switched to French or German because I loved Spanish. And I loved it because the experience I had my very first year. I was in third grade, I was 8 years old, and I walked in and every other kid in that school had been studying Spanish since kindergarten. I was a deer in headlights. And my Spanish teacher, who was this tiny woman, she was barely taller than me at eight, she gave the other kids a worksheet. She saw that I was so nervous and she pulled me aside and she said, Megan, there's nothing to be worried about. Spanish is really easy. In fact, I can teach you to read Spanish in just 5 minutes. Now, for an eight-year-old who was still struggling with long words in English, that was a ludicrous claim that she was going to be able to teach me to read. But she wrote 10 letters on the board, A-E-I-O-U-R-R-L, and an N with a squiggly mark over it, and she had me repeat after her, A-E-I-O-U-R-R-E-Y-E. And then she was right. Within 5 minutes, I was reading every word she wrote on the board, gato, plátano, perro, etc. And for me, that was magic. I was so excited that here I'd been trying to learn English reading for 4 years and still couldn't read every word, but now I could read every word in Spanish. That was so cool. So I stuck with it. And when I was 16, I studied abroad in Spain for the very first time. And then when I was in college, I interned at the Mexican embassy in the agricultural ministry. And there I learned almost as much English as I learned Spanish because, I mean, yeah, apicultura means apiculture in English, but who knew that that meant beekeeping? I didn't. Anyway. By the time I was there in Logroño at 20, I felt pretty confident in my Spanish skills. But I was a bit worried about the handball. At that point, I didn't realize that handball was a cross between soccer and basketball or any of the stuff that it was played indoors. But the head of the handball club assured me that that was not going to be a problem. The referees used universal hand signals during the game, and that wasn't why they were hiring me. The reason they were hiring me was because they were going to take everyone, the Latvian team and the referees, on a tour of the wine country beforehand. See, Logroño is the capital of La Rioja, the Rioja wine region, and so I would just get to go on this wine tour and translate for them. And so I spent the week before brushing up on my wine terms, Antocianos and Lágrima and Safios, and I thought I was ready. So I woke up bright and early that morning to meet everyone coming off the bus from Madrid. And as the team descended one by one, these huge men that were more like Shaquille O'Neal than Michael Jordan, and they were so excited to see Ilza greeting them. Lavrit, Lavrit. And I was waiting for the referees. And when these two men, who were mid-sized and middle-aged, walked down, I assumed that these were my guys. And so I walked up to them and I said, hey, good morning, how was your trip? And they looked at me really confused and said, bonjour. And as it turns out, they weren't British, as I had assumed when I was asked if I could speak English. They were Swiss. And they spoke French and Italian and German, but they didn't speak English or Spanish. So the morning was filled with a lot of hand gestures and shrugging. But as the day progressed and as the wine flowed, there was more and more laughing, because as it turns out, a wine country tour is good in any language, even one you don't speak, and you can get by doing a job that you're 0% qualified for if there's wine involved. Thanks.
Thank you, Megan. Let's give one more round of applause for Megan Zlatos. Our next storyteller is someone I have a lot of questions for, but I think he'll have a pretty great introduction coming up here. Larry Rivers came to Alaska in the 1960s and settled in Talkeetna. By chance, he was invited to guide a hunt, which then turned into a career as a global professional hunting guide. He moved into exporting, real estate development, tourism. This guy has done everything. So please give a warm welcome to Larry Rivers.
I'm gonna sit close enough, this mic, that you can hear me. So when I looked at the list of stories, the descriptions of what stories are about, I really couldn't figure out at first what one was referring to me, but finally I decided it must be the one on misleading marketing. So I started work in Russia, in the Soviet Union, actually in the 1990s, working mostly in the Russian Far East. We were there when Soviet Union fell, and then in late 1992, since the Soviet Union had collapsed and now it was all free market, everybody over there wanted to be in business. So they started all sorts of trade shows all over Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, everywhere you can imagine. We'd been running a newspaper called Vostok Rossi, and we'd been advertising in the newspaper, since advertising was free, to find out what products the Russians might be interested in. And consequently, we booked a whole bunch of trade shows, or expos as they called it, in late 1992, took a bunch of products into Russia, tried to see what our future would be. So it was myself, my son, and a Russian associate named Viktor Neomov, and we were making the whole trade show expo circuit around Europe, really just testing the waters. We were taking aluminum foil, carpet cleaner, instant potatoes, and a fruit drink similar to Kool-Aid called Flavor-Aid. Well, what we found out was they didn't have a clue what tinfoil was for, had never heard of it, couldn't imagine a use for it, and they didn't have carpets, so carpet cleaner was pretty useless. And they didn't have vacuum cleaners, so when you spread it on the carpets, it wouldn't come up, and it stained them terribly, which gave the trade show people fits. But they were really interested in the food, especially in some potatoes and Flavor-Aid. So as we did these shows, we were demonstrating, and this could be about Flavor Aid, we were demonstrating the Flavor Aid products to maybe 400 people a day for 7 days at each of these trade shows. We'd make up samples and offer them to the prospective buyers. And I'd have to say, we didn't know exactly how trade shows worked in Russia. And certainly, they didn't know how trade shows worked in Russia. They worked on the theory that, as the old Russian saying said, two Russians came together. One asked the other one if he'd like to buy a trainload of wood for $1 million. And one said, sure, he would. So the first fellow went out to find a trainload of wood, and the other went out to find $1 million. Well, that's pretty much how the whole trade show thing ran. So they didn't limit anything. They let everybody in the door. There were the people that wanted to be in retail. There were kiosk owners. There were government buyers. There were wholesalers that didn't have a clue what wholesaling was. And there were scalpers that just wanted to get free product that they could go out and sell on the street and maybe get some hard currency. And there were loads of just grandmothers and grandfathers and public and deaf and blind and thousands of the general public. Well, they flooded into the show, and a high percentage of them made it to our booth, coming over specifically to see what the magic was of this romantic place called America. Well, in presenting the foods, we handed out samples to everyone. And with Flavor Aid, we mixed up packets of each flavor and handed it out in paper cups. And those flavors included cherry, raspberry, grape, orange, tropical punch, and many more. As an aside, we immediately found out that the men gravitated to Flavor Aid. They'd scrape together the money and buy a case the first day at the exorbitant price of $8 a case, and then they'd disappear, come back in a little while, buy another $8 case, a little less coherent than the time before. And in short order, the men found out that in every single city that we did the show, they found out that Flavor Aid was really good at flavoring vodka. So they would buy a 48-pack of Flavor Aid, disappear to the back of the show, celebrate their good fortune, who knows how many bottles of vodka, and stagger back up for another case. Well, we didn't speak Russian, so Victor had taken a great deal of care with us to teach us a few words of Russian and phrases and the name of each flavor. We would hand out the samples to all the customers and the people and the grandmothers, and we would explain what the flavor was. And then if anybody showed an interest, we would refer them over to Victor that would speak to them in their native tongue and try to make a sale while we passed out more samples. It wasn't long before we noticed that there was one flavor, one out of all of them, Tropical Punch, Trupinski Punch. It was making quite an impression. We had offered it to all the men, and they would just move on to another flavor and ask questions about costs. But the women, and especially the babushkas, the little grandmothers, would take a cup, they would taste it, and they would say, oh, at the ochen horosho, meaning it's really good. Sto eto? What is it? And we would reply with great pride, at the tripiski punch. And they would shake their heads in wonderment. They would call to their friends, come on over, try some of this. And then again, they would ask, sto eto? Eto tripiski punch. Well, as they waited for their friends to come over, we were absolutely thrilled to have a product that was so interesting to everyone. Now, this went on through 5 or 6 expos, including the big shows in Moscow, Minsk, Kiev, and finally the big 12-day extravaganza in St. Petersburg Christmas show. We had hundreds and hundreds of prospective buyers from all over the Soviet Union and the satellite countries, and the gals continued to be amazed at the fine flavor of the Trupinski Punch, and they often requested samples of it, and we'd send home a couple with them. We knew we had a winner. By the time By this time, at the end of the last show, Victor was hoarse from talking to so many customers. Everyone was declaring themselves to be a volume buyer. If they could only have a couple cases of Flavor Aid for free, they'd take it to their office, and they'd put together a big order, a 40-foot container. They would pay for it in hard currency by the end of the show. Yeah, right. Well, Victor had talked so much, he could hardly talk loud enough to even be heard. So late in the show, he came over to the sample table, and he asked for a cup of Flavor Aid for his throat. I'll mention, Victor hated orange Flavor Aid. If we mentioned orange Flavor Aid or a customer did, he'd just turn his back and march away. He hated that stuff. But he liked Tropical Punch. So he asked for Tropical Punch, and I poured a cup, and I handed it to him, and as always, I said, "At the Trupinski Punch." His eyes got huge. He caught his breath, and with amazing volume, he said, "No, at the Tropicheski Punch." So then in a low voice, he said, "Not Trupinski Punch." I knew something was wrong. With a bated breath, he asked, "Have you been telling many people that?" "Yeah, everyone, at every show. Why?" He grimaced and he responded, "You spent 3 months and tens of thousands of dollars selling Trupinski Punch." So I suppose it was, in fact, false advertising.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. On today's program, we are hearing a storytelling event focusing on making some foreign faux pas. The Alaska World Affairs Council hosted this World Matters event, bringing us stories of awkward moments while traveling abroad. Let's go back to Amanda Dale with the introduction to our next storyteller.
Our next storyteller is a middle school teacher who is on hiatus, staying home to take care of his 3-year-old daughter. He's also a writer and musician, so no pressure, Mike, but if you like his story, you can find more of his works at michaelanthonysimpson.com. Please welcome Mike Simpson.
Thanks, Amanda. I grew up an Air Force brat. I've lived all over the United States, several countries, several countries overseas. Thanks. But my first year in Cordova, Alaska had the greatest impact on my life. "Let's sit at the bar. At least they have a TV," my roommate Jake said. We're both broke. I'd scraped whatever money I had, and I maxed out my credit card to pay for my plane ticket. The whole thing had been his idea. He said, he told me about a cousin of his who worked 3 summers in a cannery in Alaska, and that sounded like such a better idea than sweating my ass off in Southern California for minimum wage. So the second week of June, we were on a flight from LA to Seattle, Seattle to Anchorage, where we had a couple hours to kill before our flight to Cordova. We sat at the bar eating pretzels and drinking iced tea, the cheapest thing on the menu. When from the far side of the bar, we heard a brass bell clang, 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 and several men cheering, "Woohoo!" The bartender came around with a tray of shots, and she set 2 in front of us. I was a little confused. I'm like, "We didn't order these." And she said, "Did you hear the bell, hon? Jimbo over there bought the bar around." And she pointed to a barrel-chested man who had a sweatshirt that had a fishing boat on it that said, the Bonnie May, Ketchikan, Alaska. Several other men also had baseball caps and sweatshirts with some kind of fishing vessel on it. I thanked the bartender, unsure of what would happen if she asked for our IDs. But she just said, "Don't thank me, thank Jimbo." And we raised our glass, and he said, "It's going to be a great season, boys. May your holes stay full." And we threw him down. I was feeling all right when I got on that 21-passenger plane to Cordova. The bell rang 3 times before we left. Whiskey sloshed in my belly. My head spun as I looked out the window, but it didn't deter me from taking in the beauty of snow-capped mountains that rose from the ocean. The plane flew over a peak, a line of peaks that held back a blanket of clouds, like a dam holding back a river. And despite the long day's journey and a little help from the whiskey, a feeling of excitement welled up in me. And as the plane dove into that cloud and rocked down for a landing, my fingers tingled and my belly twisted. This would be home for the next 3 months. Jake and I were the last ones in this small building that served as the town's airport. When the ticket agent said, "Guys, I gotta lock up," I asked her, "Well, how far is the cannery and is there a shuttle that can take you there?" And she said, "It's 12 miles to town and there's no shuttle. You can call the cannery, see if anybody will pick you up." I recognized the woman's voice on the other end as the same woman I spoke to from my dorm room in San Bernardino months earlier inquiring about work. Then she'd said, "Get up here as soon as you can." And then she was like, today, she was like, "Sorry, nobody can pick you up. You have to call a cab or hitch a ride." Hitch a ride? Man, that could get you beat up, robbed, or killed in San Bernardino. The ticket agent took pity on us, and she gave us a ride, and we thanked her profusely. She said, "No problem, guys. I just hope we make it." And she glanced at her dashboard. The needle pointed to E. And I was like, "You know, we got some change we can give you." And she said, "Well, that's not it. The town's out of gas till Tuesday when the barge comes in." Out of gas till Tuesday? Man, where did we land? In the bunkhouse, I met people from all over. I met Alaskan Natives, Russians, Japanese, Hispanics, college students, college dropouts, all of us eager to start work. But the run of pink salmon hadn't started yet. So broke in a small town, only accessible by boat or plane, meant a whole lot of nothing to do. We played endless, and on top of that, the sun never set, and the rain never stopped. So we played endless games of 3-on-3 basketball on a hoop nailed to the side of a cannery, where one time at the local rec center, the local youth showed us whose court it was by raining threes and hanging on the rim, even though none were over 5'8" or the age of 15. I mean, that's all they did. In the bunkhouse, we played endless games of cards and chess, where there was a nationally ranked chess player who his only equal was this Filipino man who used to play for money on the streets of Manila. We played endless games of ping pong, where there was a small 18-year-old Pakistani kid who was unbeaten. Turned out he'd been a junior Olympian. There was a woman in her 60s who asked lots of questions and jotted things down in her journal, notes for a book she was writing. And I tasted stinkhead soup, which was made by some Alaskan natives. It uses fermented salmon heads buried in the ground for days. Despite the name, it really wasn't that bad. And it rained a lot. A local DJ played, "I can see clearly now the rain has gone." 40, 50, 60 times, I don't know, but he said, "Until the weather breaks, folks, I'm playing this." And we heard it in the cannery, and we heard it on cars going by. We just couldn't get away from it. But finally, the day came when the plant manager came roaring through the bunkhouse, waking us from our naps and rousing us from our card games. He said, let's go, the fish are in. There's money to be made." He sounded like a corporate drill sergeant. We mustered at the cannery, dressed in head to toe in rain gear, happy to finally be working. Inside there were these massive tanks that held literally tons of pink salmon that were fed down a line to this machine with a huge wheel, and they called it the chink, and they told me it was called the chink because of the sound it made. Chink, 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 chink. A steady 4-4 beat that a song like, "I can see clearly now the rain has gone," can get stuck in your head and drive you insane for 16 hours a day and bore into your 3-hour nap between shifts. This chink was designed to grab fish by the tail and whip it around, where well-placed blades cut off fins, sliced open bellies, and chopped off heads before dropping it onto a conveyor belt where there were 5 stations on either side. And that was my first job, the slime line. I pulled countless armloads of salmon carcass into my bin and cut off pieces that were missed by the chink. I remember a pink liquid that pooled at the base of the machinery, the consistency of cottage cheese, mixed with entrails and heads and fins, where it was one person's job to squeegee it into the middle of to a drain in the middle of the floor. I worked for 52 straight days in this environment of 16 to 20 hours a day. By season's end, half the crew was gone, including Jake. Burnt out, washed out, back to school. I was feeling all right when I got on that 21-passenger plane out of Cordova. We'd had a bonfire the night before where we burned abandoned clothing that had been rotting with fish slime and scales. I was drunk after two beers, and I kept drinking. I kept hearing that imaginary brass bell from the far side of the bell of the bar. And when I had, my feet were swollen with trench foot, my fingers and my wrists ached with carpal tunnel, and I had a persistent cough from a type of bronchitis called fish lung that was caused by the emission of gases from the intestines of fish. But as the plane rose into that blanket of cloud, my body tingled. My credit card was paid off, my next semester of school was paid for, and I had three uncashed paychecks in my pocket. And when the plane broke over those peaks that were holding back the blanket and over the ocean where snow-capped mountains met the sea, I smiled and a song played in my head. I can see clearly now the rain has gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mike. I love Mike's story because I also worked at a cannery in Cordova for a summer many years ago. And although it was a different cannery, the pink slime was the same. So it was really nice to hear that again.
This is KSKA Anchorage. You are listening to Addressing Alaskans. Today we are hearing from a World Matters storytelling event titled Foreign Faux Pas, Stories of Navigating Cultural Differences, hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Storytellers are sharing some moments when they realized they were a little far from home. Let's return to our moderator, Amanda Dale, with the introduction to our next storyteller.
Our fourth storyteller, you have probably heard her name before. She's the president of Anchorage School Board. And before that, she was a teacher here for about 22 years. She's also lived a lot of life outside of Anchorage. She's been to more than 70 countries, speaks a lot of languages, and she's taught English in Africa and Asia. So we're really pleased to welcome Tam Agosti-Giesler.
Thank you. So, I've never been arrested in this country because I'm a law-abiding citizen. And I understand the language, English, and the norms and mores of our culture. However, when I've gone traveling, I haven't always been so lucky. The first time I was ever detained occurred when I was on a trip with my best friend from high school, Michelle, who, by the way, is here this evening. And we were backpacking Europe using Eurail passes. And we were on a train in Italy going from Florence up to Munich, Germany. Well, unbeknownst to us, you don't only get on the right car in Italy, the right train in Italy, you have to get in the right car. And when we reached Trieste, they split the train in half, unbeknownst to us, and sent half of it north to Munich and the other half east, towards Yugoslavia, the Soviet bloc, Yugoslavia, to the part that today is called Slovenia. I'm looking at my map, and Michelle says to me, what's that body of water? And I said, oh, I don't know, it's some unnamed lake. We soon found out it was the Adriatic Sea. We found that out when they came on the train for passport control. We had no visas to be in Yugoslavia. So they took us off the train and took us to the police station right next to the train, where they proceeded to question us in an incomprehensible language. We got out of that with our tears and our youthful appearance. They laughed at us, stamped visas in our passport, and told us to get back on the train. Our relief was short-lived because a few minutes later they came for our train tickets. Our year rail passes were only good in Western Europe. So when the train conductor realized we had no tickets, he decided to use the one line of English he had learned from an American movie on me. He put his arm around me and he said, "What's the matter, baby?" I was not amused. So through a complicated series of transactions of currency, this is long before the euro, we were able to, with some Finnish girls, change to Finnish money to change to this money. Anyway, in the end, we ended up with enough of the money they used in Yugoslavia, I don't even remember the name at this point, to buy a train ticket. And that took us right to Ljubljana, where we got off the train and went over to the train board and in the Cyrillic alphabet tried to figure out which was the word Munich. We took a gamble that this was it and realized the train was leaving in 3 minutes. So these two young girls with these big orange backpacks raced, hopped on this train, and we were really thrilled to find out it was the train indeed to Munich. It took us the rest of the day to get to Munich. We arrived about 11 p.m., and the youth hostel had already closed. Michelle pulled out the American Express card her father had given her only for emergencies, and we checked into a nice hotel to make up for our very hard day. The second time I was arrested occurred about 4 years later. I was a student in West Berlin. This is in the days when there was still an East Germany and a West Germany and a wall around West Berlin. Our professor took us on a field trip to Potsdam for the day and had special permission to use an exit in the wall that went directly to Potsdam. And we had special passes that were good just for 24 hours to use that exit in the wall. We did our class, we had our instruction, and at the end, it was late afternoon, he said, "You're free to spend the rest of the afternoon in Potsdam, or you can go back with me. But you need to know there's a special bus stop that you have to go to get on the special bus to go through the special gate in the wall. And your passes are only good to midnight, so don't miss the last bus." Well, he gave all these instructions in German, but I decided to spend the day with Steve, whose German was much better than mine, because I figured what I didn't understand, he had caught. And so we'd find the bus stop. Bad move. Steve hadn't understood, or he wasn't listening, because when it came time to find the bus stop, he asked numerous East Germans, and they had no idea where this special bus was to go to West Berlin, obviously. So it took a long time. We finally found a bus stop that we were supposed to stand. We waited for a long time, and no bus ever came. This was a cold, dark February night, and I was wearing high-heel boots, not unlike what I have on right now. But we didn't have a lot of options. We didn't want to be stuck there in East Germany without passes past midnight. So we started walking on the freeway towards the wall. Suddenly I remembered, didn't they tell us it's illegal to walk along the freeway in East Germany? And then, because I'm an Alaskan and I know better than walking in high heel boots, I also said, this is too difficult. I keep sinking in the snow. And as we approach the wall, do you suppose they're going to shoot before they ask, thinking we're East Germans trying to escape? And then there's that issue of the landmines. So we said, no, we can't do this. We stuck out our thumbs. We said, we're going to hitchhike. The next car, wouldn't you know it, was the Volpos. These are the East German Volkspolizei, or the state police. They jumped out of their car. They surrounded us with guns and proceeded to interrogate us in German. Steve, whose German was superior to mine, became a babbling fool. And when they asked for our papers, he was so nervous, when he ripped them out of his pocket, he ripped them in half. So they thought he was being a smart aleck. They shoved us in their car, and they drove to the station right at the gate and told us, stay in the car. And as they went in to try to figure out what they're going to do with these two Americans, here comes the bus. And the bus stops right next to the car. And all of our fellow students are pointing at us, saying, what are Tam and Steve doing in that police car? And right then, the supervisor comes out, and I said in impeccable German that this was the bus that we were supposed to be on. These were our fellow students, and that's where we needed to be. And he said, get out and get on, which we did. Returned to campus, where I drank copious amounts of beer that night. In 1988-89, my husband and I drove from Anchorage to the southern tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, which afforded us countless opportunities to be detained, arrested, or questioned by police, military, and anyone else who had a gun. The most harrowing experience happened in Panama City. This was, if you recall your history, at the time when the CIA was trying to oust Noriega. And so Americans weren't exactly the favored tourists, especially not of the Panamanian Defense Force. Some people call them Noriega's thugs. We had been reading in our South American handbook that the best place to stay to find other travelers to split the cost of a shipping van to South America was at the Hippodrome. And if you're wondering, there's a 150-mile gap between Panama and Colombia where there is no road, so you must ship. So we were camped at the Hippodrome trying to find some other travelers, split the shipping cost. It was a very hot night. We had a Volkswagen van. We had the back open, and we're sleeping. We're awakened to flashlights in the eyes, machine guns to our heads, and someone yelling, Americanos! Americanos! Even though I was scared to death, I was able to spit out, no, Svisos. And this was the one time I was thrilled that I had married a Swiss citizen and we had dual nationality. So even though I was scared in the dark of the night, I reached into our secret compartment and I pulled out our Swiss passports and made sure our American ones were deep in there. And gave them our Swiss passports. And the gentleman, still with their machine guns on us, said to me, ¿Por qué tienes placas de Alaska? Why do you have license plates from Alaska? First of all, I was really impressed that he knew Alaska was part of the United States. But I didn't have time to spend on that, and I told him, I quickly made up a story about how we flew from Switzerland to Alaska, and we bought the van there, and we were driving down to Tierra Fuego. It was enough to convince them to put their machine guns down, and then they proceeded to tell us, why are you camped here? And we said, oh, we were told we can meet other travelers here, and they said, you need to know that the Hippodrome is where we have several homicides every night. So we want you to lock up your doors, and when we go on our patrol, we'll be back here in 2 hours, and when we do this, please let us know if you're still alive. They left, and I turned to my husband, and I said, get the hell out of here. And we went and parked on Embassy Row, and then we went and checked into a B&B until we could ship the van ourselves, paying for the entire container ourselves to Venezuela. So the moral of the story is, even if you do try to follow rules, oftentimes you don't know the rules, and it also hones your problem-solving skills. Thank you.
Thank you, Tam. Let's have one more round of applause for Tam Agosti-Giesler. Our fifth and final storyteller tonight is an Alaskan transplant from Iowa. She's been a cab driver in Homer. She's been an adventure guide. She's been a Fulbright scholar in Brazil. She's been all over the place. We're really pleased to welcome her tonight with our final story. Please give a warm round of applause for Rebecca Potterbaum.
You forgot the walking faux pas as part of my description. Hi. When I travel, I like to pack light. Okay, sure. Socks, toothbrush, the essentials. But it really helps that words are really lightweight. And a sense of humor, it weighs even less. Yeah, I know you want to test this out. Basically, a pocket full of jokes is pretty much the most important thing that I pack in general, be it Alaska or be it abroad. Okay, my favorite, one of my favorites. a bear walks into a bar, and he says to the bartender, he says, "Hey, I'd like a gin." And tonic. And the bartender says, yeah, okay. But what's with the big paws? I don't know. I'm a bear. One of my favorites forever. You can use that later. Okay, yeah, they're all equal caliber. Not highbrow humor, let's face it. But this is me. I'm just being me, right? So when I love traveling, but I love just being able to just dive into what it is that makes a place tick. And so when I find myself studying in Spain, this is years of studying Spanish language, but I'm full up from a semester of art history and eating a lot of tapas and a lot of dinner parties with my newfound friends who are just awesome. And this is talking about everything from internet politics and art and everything that's way over my head for months. But there comes a night at the end of a semester, and it was that night where maybe it was the wine, maybe it was my comfort with people, and finally that meshing, that beautiful moment that many of you guys know when you've been studying a language for a while, that it just, you understand humor. Current events, whatever, they just like little political banter, this and this, and you're just like, oh my God, I get that too. Oh my God, well, with me, that means I want to participate. Yeah, guys, I got this joke. Había un oso que entró en un bar y pidió del camarero y quiero un ginebra y, oh no. This only works in English, because Paul says not the same as patitos, but it's really funny in English, because the same word for like the long length of time, it's really funny because it's the same as like the bare hands, and I mean, yeah. I don't know, I'm a faux pas. But what my Spanish friends really did teach me, not only that I needed to learn some new jokes, is that how to talk around a topic, especially if you didn't have all the right words for that topic, right? So fast forward, and I've transplanted to Brazil. I did not have the luxury to study Portuguese in depth before I went, so I came with a lot of words that had nothing to do with this place, but a little budding sense of vocabulary and a lot of probably over-exuberant enthusiasm, and boom, in a small town. And turns out, hey, my project is not going to start in the same timeline that I'm there at, so hey, I've got a lot of free time. So, going to do a lot of listening, a lot of talking to people who probably can't run away from me. Cue my 80-year-old neighbor. Awesome. So we're just talking pretty much every day, but you know, there are only so many mornings you can talk about bolo, breakfast cake, and then before the conversation pretty much becomes pretty rote, right? So I was like looking for things to do, and I found a guitar class. I was super stoked. Senhora, I signed up for this guitar class. I'm so excited. And she's like, ah, but why? You know? And I was like, yeah, because I'm bored. But I wanted to say bored, but I was like, ooh, that's a word I don't know yet. But you know, how do you describe or talk around a word when you're not really sure what it means in English? I mean, think about this. So start saying, you know, like when you don't know where to go, but like you don't know the place going. Oh God, that sounds like I'm lost. You know, when you can't think of what to do, but the things. God, I'm using very little words. That sounds like I just forgot. Senora, do you ever like, I don't know, eat when you're not hungry? She's like, da gulosa. And I was like, gulosa, great. Okay, I signed up for a guitar class because I'm gulosa. This is great, whatever. Fine. I, as a linguist, just enthusiast, word enthusiast, a lot of linguists agree that you need about 7 exposures to a word before it really sticks as part of your vocabulary or your experience. So I'm gonna use my new words everywhere I go. Yeah, sign up for a violon class because I am glossa. Yeah! Everybody knows I am in studying guitar. I mean, granted, my teacher's like an overly zealous U2 fan, so it's really not like really highbrow, but it's like, it's pretty exciting to me. And I finally like, okay, my project's finally gonna start, and I have a meeting with my, we'll call her the Secretary of Education of the municipality that I'm in. This is a great opportunity to talk about, you know, the beginning stages of this project. And so at the end of this meeting, she's like, oh, hey, Beck, are you starting to, you know, get comfortable? Are you accustomed to this place? I was like, I love it. I have a great neighbor. We eat cake all the time. I signed up for a violon class. And you know what? I'm not glossa anymore. And she's like, hey, Becca, you Americans eat all the time, don't you? I was like, wait. But I was talking about guitar. Wait, what? No. It's pretty common there, right? And I'm just like, Wait. Disculpa, senora. I pulled out my pocket dictionary. Like, this is before I had a smartphone, guys, so don't judge. Like, pulled out my pocket dictionary, and this is where you realize your over-exuberant, like fanaticism for, like, using new words before you knew what they meant means that you'd been telling the entire town that you'd been gluttonous instead of bored. And so... Oh, that, how's that for, you know, cultural citizen diplomacy, right? Right there. Doing really great for the American side. Anyway, so having the right words or not being a walking faux pas or having graceful exits doesn't mean that I take my virtual packing any less, but this is just why it's really important to just take out of your baggage anything that might make you take yourself seriously, or just a little too seriously, because I don't know, I'm just gonna be myself.
Let's have one more round for Rebecca and all 5 of our storytellers.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've just heard Foreign Faux Pas, Stories of Navigating Cultural Differences. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council on March 22nd. If you missed a portion of the show, you can always go back and listen to it again by visiting the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.